The first cleaner lecture will be by Dr. Patrick Soglos. That is on resources and technologies for future aquaculture, a needs assessment for sustainable development. Dr. Patrick Soglos is a professor of aquaculture at Ghent University in Belgium, and he has been involved in fish and shellfish larvae culture, R&D in Europe, Asia, Latin America and Africa since mid-1970s. He initiated aquaculture education at Ghent University, and so far over 250 masters and 50 PhDs have been graduated under his supervision in the field of aquaculture. Professor Soglos is a strong promoter of international networking in aquaculture and is involved in many partners and networks, including World Aquaculture Society, European Commission, European Aquaculture Technology and Innovation Platform. Also, he received honorary awards from China, Egypt, Greece, Thailand, and US and Vietnam. I cordially invite Dr. Patrick Soglos to offer his presentation.
Sawadee kap. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, dear colleagues and friends, ladies and gentlemen. My sincere thanks first to the conference organizers for the trust and confidence in asking me to present this plenary lecture on the needs assessment of resources, technologies, and services for aquaculture in the decade ahead of us. As suggested by FAO, I have prepared this presentation in the perspective of global aquaculture developments as we have experienced these ever since the first technical conference on aquaculture in Kyoto in 1976, which in fact was my first experience in Asia, as maybe you can see here on this picture. Indeed, my staff and myself have been very fortunate through our research and development work with brine shrimp artemia to follow aquaculture developments on the four continents. And this starting in Asia in 1976, when Dr. Herminio Rabanal from the Philippines proposed to verify our hypotheses for artemia introductions in seasonal salt operations in Southeast Asia. In an introductory part, I will quickly review some statistics and draw the attention to a few key developments in modern history of aquaculture. Next, I want to draw your attention to some facts and figures that remind us of the challenges ahead of us, but also to reveal the unique opportunities for more proactive aquaculture. I will then propose a priority list of what I consider critical needs for a successful and especially a sustainable development of aquaculture into the next decades. To finally conclude with some general recommendations for more international interactions at the multi-stakeholder level. First, about the history of aquaculture. With a few facts and figures, I want to set the scene. I then like to classify aquaculture practices under two categories. Food aquaculture, as practiced since millennia in Asia, and business aquaculture, the more recent developments in aquaculture, which have resulted in new practices with different systems and species. And finally, as an illustration, I will touch upon a few success stories to this mode of business aquaculture. As we heard yesterday, aquaculture is the fastest growing food production industry. It all started in Asia, especially in China, but it was only in the last 3 to 4 decades that spectacular growth took place. Finfish are making up half of the production, with the remaining 50% about equally divided over seaweeds and mollusks. When expressed in monetary value, the small quantity of farmed crustaceans, mainly the pinnate shrimp, now make up 20% of the value of all aquaculture products, with seaweeds and mollusks now reduced to 15%, respectively 10%, as their overall market value is lower than for crustaceans and even many fish species. As Senna has convincingly reminded us yesterday, Asia and the Pacific are responsible for nearly 90% of the production. Although value-wise, Europe and Latin America make up 20% because their aquaculture products fetch higher market values. I know that I'm overly simplifying things, but for easier analysis and comparison, I want to classify aquaculture under two categories, so-called food aquaculture and business aquaculture. Food aquaculture is the millennia-old traditional farming of freshwater fish in ponds in Asia. This food security approach is mainly for the farmers' own needs or for catering for very local markets. Still today, this pond production practice is very important as it provides close to 15 million tons annually in China alone. Typical for this traditional food aquaculture is the integrated approach, farming of fish in combination with other farming practices. Fish in the ditches of the rice paddies, fish feeding on periphyton, decaying plant material, and insects. Or integrated with the farming of terrestrial animals, chicken, ducks, pigs, using waste and byproducts as direct and as indirect food sources. Business aquaculture is a much more recent phenomenon. It was pioneered by the Japanese as of the 60s. Later, it was taken up and further developed in Europe, the USA, Australia, etc. Main principle here is to engage in the farming of high market value species following capital-intensive business models. These aquaculture businesses could become feasible thanks to new insights in the biology and life cycle of the target organisms. For example, on how parental stock could be induced to maturation. The development of hatchery techniques allowed to grow massive quantities of fry in hatcheries. Fingerlings could be stocked in high-density grow-out systems. Similar to the plant and animal farming practices on land, this business aquaculture is always performed on a monoculture basis. Let's review some typical examples. More or less sophisticated cage structures in fjords and bays, eventually moving out more and more to open seas. Land-based systems can be operated in ponds, but we have many examples as well in concrete, raceways, and tanks. And in recent years, we see more and more recirculation systems that have gained a lot of interest as they allow to produce the products close to a captive market, maybe at a higher cost, and often in temperate and cold climates. Success stories are numerous, although most have or are still experiencing rough times. Atlantic salmon farming in many respects is a classical example that has set the scene for many other types of business aquaculture. A first example of such ups and downs is the overproduction in the early 90s in Norway, which resulted in severe financial crisis. that was finally remedied by better marketing efforts. Developing new outlets even resulted in further expansion of the industry. Another example with Atlantic salmon has to do with diseases. Although much progress was made in disease control, lack of basic biosecurity measures has been at the origin of the recent devastating problems in Chile that maybe will take years to recover of the present economical setback. The same salmon farming can be practiced under highly automated conditions, as in this very profitable venture off the Trondheim Fjord in Norway. At water depths of more than 50 meters, cages with a capacity of 1,000 tons of salmon each are operated by a crew of less than 10 people. High automation and especially thorough specialization are keys to success here. Another success story is the Pinnae shrimp. Following very profitable decades in the 70s and 80s, shrimp aquaculture experienced a very rough decade in the 90s with severe disease problems caused by poor management practices and uncontrolled transfers of contaminated broodstock or post-larvae. The introduction of domesticated and special pathogen-free white shrimp, Pinnaeus venamae, enabled more predictable growth of the industry. Pangasius farming in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam will enter history books as a typical example of business aquaculture adopted in a developing country. Once maturation and hatchery practices could be mastered, the farming in floating cages and later on in ponds expanded at a phenomenal rate. And new markets, especially in Europe, were eager to introduce Pangasius fillets as a cheap substitute for the more expensive whitefish from classical fisheries. A success story indeed, but one under serious threat as well, because of biosecurity issues and limited attention to sustainability matters. Another example of business aquaculture, be it at a very local level, is the Chinese mitten crab industry. Following the catastrophe with the white spot syndrome virus disease in coastal shrimp farming in the early 90s in China, reconversion to mitten crab seed production really paid off. Production outputs are still on the increase as local markets are further expanding and new farming practices are successfully explored. For example, the polyculture of mitten crab in rice paddies, even far inland in western China. Outside Asia, we often forget how successful mollusk farming has become, with more than 14 million tons annually. And seaweed production as well, 16 million tons annually. As we will see in a moment, these two latter forms of aquaculture deserve much more attention in the future. Let's move on to the expectations for future aquaculture. What are the challenges and the threats that we are facing? Are there any opportunities? As our world population continues to grow and consumers become increasingly interested in the health benefits of eating seafood, market demands for aquatic products will further expand in the years to come. Fisheries are stagnating and might even level off, so aquaculture will have to grow even faster. In the decades ahead, freshwater will become increasingly scarce, and maybe we should turn towards the seas and oceans for a sustainable source of our food supplies. First, some FAO data. Over the past three decades, we have seen a progressive increase of the contribution of aquaculture to our world seafood needs. It was less than 10% in the 70s. Now it's close to 50% of what we consume is produced in farms. This trend will continue as demands are increasing and fisheries stocks are exploited near or over maximum sustainable yields. Calculations based on present per capita consumption and taking into account population numbers in a decade from now reveal that aquaculture will have to provide more than 25% extra on an annual basis within the next 10 years. When considering the available global resources for food extraction or production, it is clear that land for crops and for pasture will come under serious pressure. However, the vast area of seas and oceans should be better exploited for mariculture developments and eventually play a much more important role in the production of food for mankind. Global primary production is as important in the seas and oceans as it is on land. However, big surprise to the right, today the marine environment contributes less than 2% in our food supply. It is largely because of historical reasons that today aquaculture production is only slightly higher in marine waters as compared to the freshwater habitats. In future decades, we can expect and in fact should promote a significant shift to farming the oceans and the seas. I hope I have convinced you that aquaculture is expected to expand very significantly. However, the question is, can this all be achieved following our current experience and expertise? Can it be accomplished without causing environmental risks or human health problems? I think the answer is yes, but only when we move into a higher gear. We cannot continue along the empirical path of the past. Maybe this has been an appropriate approach for the time being, trial and error along sound scientific principles. With the challenges ahead of us, we need to develop a more knowledge-based bioindustry. We need to understand the underlying mechanisms in all the biological processes responsible for the final production outcome. Only then we can develop a more predictable, a more reliable, a more cost-effective, and ultimately a more sustainable industry. Here is a long list of what I consider to be the priority needs for future aquaculture. Most of these will be discussed in great detail by the three expert panels following the coffee break. Let me briefly touch upon each of them. First, the lack of domestication. We are still many years behind terrestrial animal farming. As for many aquatic species, I think I should rather say for most species, we are still hunting for breeders or for seed, with all consequences of introducing a lot of variability. A year of good performers versus a year of poor stock. Eventually carrying parasites or even commensals that can turn into nasty bugs under farm conditions. Second, seed production of these delicate aquatic organisms remains a challenge. Not so much in terms of numbers produced, as today many billions of fish and shellfish offspring are produced in more or less sophisticated hatcheries. However, predictability of production, and especially cost efficiency, can be improved a lot. Let's take the example of the bass and bream hatchery industry in the Mediterranean, a sector with an annual turnover of more than 150 million euro. With present survival figures of only 20% up to day 60 post-hatching, I think you understand that there is much room for improvement. And this not only from a cost efficiency point of view, but for environmental and overall sustainability reasons as well. Microbial interference is often cited as the source of problems. Harmful bacteria, not necessarily the virulent pathogens, which develop during live food production, the microalgae, the rotifers, the artemia, these bacteria are carried along with the live food into the larval rearing tank, where they can interfere with the very sensitive physiological developments of the larvae. For example, interfering in their digestive physiology or their immune system. This study of host-microbe interactions requires a different approach as compared to the former black box research, which didn't allow us to come up with reproducible results. Interactions between host, environment, and the microbial communities are just too multiple and complex to try to unravel under in vivo trials, as we all have tried to do in the years that have gone by. Similar to work performed with terrestrial animals, work done with mice, with pigs, with sheep, farmed in bacteria-free conditions, first results with aquatic species prove that much fundamental progress can be made when working with so-called gnotobiotic model systems. Let me just show you two results with European sea bass larvae cultured under bacteria-free conditions over a period of 20 days and fed with bacteria-free live food, brine shrimp Artemia nauplii. Please realize this is of academic interest. We are not propagating here that in the future we should go for bacteria-free larviculture. As we can see here, several repetitions in time documented what we knew from commercial operations. Under so-called optimal conditions, this is the classical green water approach, unpredictable mortalities always occur in the first weeks of larval development and result in big standard deviations. The bacteria-free treatments, however, are much more stable and yield very high survivals throughout the first weeks of larval development. Even greater is the surprise when we exposed similar treatments to stress conditions. In this case, intermittent cycles of light and dark, a condition that is well known by hatchery managers to be very stressful for the larvae and often resulting in extra mortalities. Yes, we can document this phenomenon for the control treatment. However, the larvae kept under the bacteria-free conditions display minimal effects. Or in other words, it could be that at mouth opening, some of the bacteria that enter the intestine might activate the wrong triggers and have a negative effect on the physiological conditions of the larvae. These are very valuable empirical observations that can now be further analyzed with molecular tools to unravel gene expression in these developing larvae exposed to a well-defined condition. Such multidisciplinary research, as outlined here for the study of the possible effects of the magic green water technique in fish and shellfish larvae culture, this is the type of work we need in different areas of aquaculture research. Only then we can gain more basic insights of underlying biological mechanisms to allow us to develop appropriate solutions for application under practical farming conditions. For back to seed production, the ultimate goal, the ultimate aim should be to develop new hatchery practices, for example, with regard to microbial steering, and apply innovative products, for example, as substrate for specific bacteria, or as signal molecules to disrupt virulence triggers. All this could ultimately result in more cost-effective hatchery production of certified seed with improved characteristics. For the next priority, we need more proactive attention for species selection. We should not aim to increase our palmarès of numbers of species being farmed, but rather be more selective in identifying suitable species for mass markets, such as Pangasius, and niche species catering for local markets, where added value products might be in good demand. Working with a more limited number of species should allow us to be more focused in our research. Demand for more selective breeding work comes under priority 4. Again, an area where we are far behind the terrestrial plant and animal industry. There is great need to invest in breeding research for key aquatic species, as in this example for tiger shrimp, Peneus monodon, for which finally good progress has been made in recent years. A lot of the tools that have been developed in plant genomic breeding can be applied with aquatic animals to speed up selection work. Genomic sequence comparison with model species can help in identifying best breeding aims. Again, we can learn from practices in plant breeding. Sooner rather than later, we can think about selecting and even designing new varieties that are better adapted, for example, for the adverse effects of climate change. Back to the bacteria. Thanks to the availability of new genomic tools, a lot of research has been initiated in recent years on the role of microorganisms in agriculture, in human health, food quality, etc. This brings me to the next priority. As water is an ideal environment for microbial developments, the role of bacteria, beneficial as well as harmful, in aquaculture systems requires much more research attention. Their role in the aquatic environment in water quality control, but also how they can contribute in converting organic waste matter into nutritious biomass. These so-called biofloocs are rich in protein, but are often also high in specific micronutrients, for example, omega-3 fatty acids and vitamins. Controlled biofloc production could greatly contribute to increased sustainability and more biosecure production systems through reduced needs for water exchange and more efficient feed conversion. Instead of limiting its application within the same species production, as is now practiced with tilapia and shrimp, I think that biofloocs could be more effectively used in multi-species farming. For example, when integrating intensive fish or shrimp production and the biofloocs these generate with the farming of filter feeding species that could convert the biofloocs into mollusk meat or brine shrimp biomass that can easily be harvested for use as food ingredient with other species. As documented with terrestrial animals, chicken, pigs, and cattle, host microbe interactions can greatly influence production results. Not only at the start of larval development, as we have seen a while ago, but also in juvenile and adult stages. Recent papers have also documented how such interactions can be applied to improve the health status of the animals, or how the control of the bacterial flora, both in quantity as in composition, can have an impact on the animal's performance. Let's take the example of pH modulation in the digestive tract of juvenile sea bass. Lowering the intestinal pH by delivery and release of a mild organic acid, for example butyric acid, from 7.7 to 7.3, this results in a significant shift of the microbial composition, as documented here by DNA fingerprinting of the bacteria, and a growth increase of more or less 20%. Again, these are empirical observations. Now they require further nutritional research to reveal the functional role of the bacteria in the animal's digestive physiology, and who knows, maybe also its immunology. Priority 6. Our knowledge of health control in aquatic animals is still very limited, especially in the invertebrates, the crustaceans and the mollusks. Much more basic work using molecular tools should improve our knowledge of activation, good functioning, and disrupting the animal's immune systems. Only then we will be able to move from empirical trial and error practice today, with all kinds of putative immunostimulants, pre and probiotics, to knowledge-based strategies and products. With some species, such as salmon, our knowledge is far advanced, and different generations of vaccines have proven their efficacy. However, as stated here by a major player in this field of veterinary medicine, vaccines are not a magical solution, and scientific progress should only be part of a more concerted effort in health management. Priority 7. When addressing sustainability issues in future aquaculture development, we must think more along ecological principles and reconsider the monoculture approaches that we have increasingly introduced with the modern form of business aquaculture. Also, in terrestrial farming, a paradigm shift is considered to meet the food production needs of the decades ahead, with limited land availability and especially the scarce freshwater reserves for plant and for meat production. Conclusions that were made just a week ago at a meeting in Brussels talking about the bioeconomy and food production by 2020. Hydroponics, integrated with high-density fish farming and recirculation systems, is under testing in various regions of the world. Several research agencies are considering demonstration research of integrated farming of terrestrial and aquatic plants and animals, taking advantage of modern tools in sensor-controlled nutrient dosing, heat and energy recuperation, etc. However, moving away from monoculture practices will not be an easy task, as the socio-economic consequences of integrating different food production industries will require important mentality shifts. Back to the seas for priority number 8. Earlier this morning, we touched upon the observation that oceans and seas make up 70% of our global bioresources. I think we cannot delay we cannot delay any longer to pay much more attention to the marine environment. An opportunity not only to satisfy seafood market needs, but also to offer aquatic proteins instead of terrestrial meat as a more sustainable food source for humankind in the decades to come. Several think tanks come to the conclusion that by the middle of this century, we might not have enough fresh water to continue producing meat. I think the time has come to make a thorough reflection about future directions in coastal and offshore farming. Let me make some other simplistic classification of present-day aquaculture practices. We have fed aquaculture practices, the farming of fish and crustaceans in cages and ponds, but we also have extractive, non-fed aquaculture practices with seaweeds, removing mineral, nitrogen and phosphorus, and filter feeders, the mollusks, grazing on organic nitrogen and phosphorus. Pressure on the environment is very clear in such open pond farming of shrimp or fish. Same here when trash fish or even formulated feeds are used in high-density fish cages in shallow coastal waters. We could learn a lot from the empirical practices set up in a few coastal regions in China, where initially, and that was starting in the 1950s, only seaweeds were farmed, as in the picture I have shown just a while ago. Later, when mollusk seed could be produced in hatcheries, seaweeds and different mollusk species were grown together. Over the last decade, marine fish cages have been added. Some of these areas are very vast, tens of square kilometers in surface, as can be seen here from a satellite picture. In recent years, several international research teams have analyzed nutrient flows in such polyculture systems and came to the conclusion that most of these can be classified as oligotrophic environments. Multitropic aquaculture is the future, but we do realize that it will require a lot of effort to motivate farmers and industries that operate today in a very competitive world. With what we have seen in China, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but rather should try to cooperate. Governments should become more proactive in facilitating demonstration projects in cooperation with and under joint management of private companies. China is also experimenting with polyculture systems with benthic species that benefit from nutrients accumulating under the mollusk long lines or the fish cages. As we can see here in this table, significant harvests can be obtained with different mollusk, sea urchin, and sea cucumber species. What we often overlook is the role of seaweeds in bioremediation, for example, in rehabilitation of coastal environments. If the Chinese had not engaged in massive seaweed farming in the past 4 or 5 decades, coastal eutrophication today would have been much more critical. Close to 10 million tons of seaweeds are harvested every year along China's coast. I think I should rather express this in the hundreds of thousands of tons of nitrogen and phosphorus that are being removed on an annual basis. For sure, this aquaculture activity has significantly alleviated coastal eutrophication. When talking about the need and potential for more integration, we should not limit ourselves to aquaculture activities only. New offshore infrastructures are being built for energy generation, be it wind or waves. These constructions could provide the right facilities for integration with cage and long-line farming of fish, mollusk, and seaweed species. Both sectors of energy and food production could develop interesting synergies. Priority 9. Based on progress made over the last years, I think we can be optimistic that the fish oil paradox in aquaculture is gradually being resolved. Much more work, however, is still needed, and we might also expect that approaches followed will differ from region to region. More about this in the third panel discussion of this thematic session. Last but not the least, I would like to make a strong plea to devote more attention to the possible integration of restocking activities with fisheries management. We heard yesterday from Dr. Jia Jiansan that this particular Bangkok 2000 recommendation was poorly met. There is much empirical evidence of the benefits of restocking projects, both in freshwater and marine environments. However, there is also much criticism about possible impact on biodiversity issues and on overall cost effectiveness. Let's bring fishery scientists and aquaculture researchers together to engage in a multidisciplinary R&D program to better evaluate the technical and socio-economic potential, especially now that we have much better analytical tools to engage in such large-scale experiments. Fishermen are more than eager to cooperate in such studies. We were involved in a small turbot release program along the North Sea coast and got excellent support from local fishermen who recaptured 30% of the released fish that had migrated within a year's time from Belgium to all over the North Sea, as you can see in the following animation. The time lapse of recapture recording is 1 year from release. This brings me to the last item on the list, societal leverage. This will be important if we want to accomplish the priorities we have just discussed. We need a multi-stakeholder approach involving all key players to decide on priorities and to make sure that all noses are turned in the same direction. We heard yesterday about the important trade flows into the USA, into Europe. International cooperation, with due respect for cultural differences, is a must and will require more efforts to reach compromises. However, I'm convinced that there are many opportunities between North and South, East and West, to develop win-win opportunities, even in sectors where today it looks like tension is building up. Dr. Varadi yesterday referred to the recent creation of the European Aquaculture Technology and Innovation Platform. This umbrella organization of all key stakeholders in European aquaculture is promoted by the European Commission and aims to establish a strong relationship between aquaculture and the consumer, with the assurance of developing a sustainable industry, fulfilling as well its role in society at large. With business leaders in the driving seat, the board of directors, and with the participation of all stakeholders, ETIP is now finalizing its vision document, Aquaculture 2030, and based on this, its strategic research agenda. Speaking with one voice, ETIP wants to ensure better leverage to address particular issues, such as research priorities, legislation issues, and international cooperation. Through its recently established international desk, ETIP wants to become more proactive in exploring and facilitating win-win interactions with other regions in the world. Here, for example, with Asian partners, in view of the very good relations established between both regions by the AZEM Aquaculture Platform. We hope that more of these multi-stakeholder platforms can be set up to stimulate regional interactions in the world of aquaculture. Thank you for your attention. Kapukam.